Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today. Not live today, coming to you today on WILL-AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking about American politics, racial politics, and what's going on at America's high schools, colleges, and universities. We're going to have a terrific guest today, but before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
As 2010 draws to a close, we take a look back at the top Media Minute stories this year. The year began with a court battle over the Federal Communications Commission's authority over the communications medium of our time. In April, a federal appeals court ruled that the FCC lacked the authority to regulate broadband services, complicating FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski's plans to protect the open internet or achieve the goals of the National Broadband Plan. Public interest groups, consumer advocates, small businesses, nonprofits, and millions of everyday people pressured the agency for months to reassert their authority over the internet and pass strong net neutrality rules. Activists exposed backroom meetings at the FCC, met with their members of Congress to demand net neutrality, and even took to the streets of Silicon Valley when Google and Verizon struck a pact that threatened the open internet. In the end, more than 2 million people contacted the FCC to demand real net neutrality, the principle that prevents internet service providers like Comcast and AT&T from speeding up or slowing down websites, services, or applications online. In their December meeting, the FCC passed net neutrality rules that were criticized by open internet advocates for not going far enough. They leave users of wireless devices like mobile phones unprotected, and there are big loopholes in the rules that could allow the big companies to divide the internet into fast and slow lanes. Worse still, the FCC hasn't resolved the issues surrounding its authority over broadband, meaning even these watered-down rules could be at risk in court.
The fall of 2010 marked another round of grant recipients in the Broadband Technologies Opportunity Program. The Detroit Digital Justice Coalition, an alliance of organizations and individuals who believe that communication is a fundamental human right, was awarded approximately $2 million in federal broadband stimulus funds in partnership with Michigan State University to support community organizing and economic development. With a goal of creating a media-based economy in the city, the project will create 12 public computer centers and train digital media educators and entrepreneurs from the community in a wide range of skills. In Philadelphia, the Urban Affairs Coalition, which includes longtime media justice advocates, the Media Mobilizing Project, was awarded $11.8 million to ensure broadband adoption in the city. Their project, called Freedom Rings, will provide training, specifically in skills development, education, healthcare, and media production.
2010 gave us a glimpse of the new face of media consolidation. The proposed merger of Comcast, the nation's largest cable and residential broadband provider, and NBC, one of America's most popular broadcast and production companies, would give one company enormous control over what you can watch and how you can watch it. The cable giant spent most of the year wooing regulators, investing tens of millions on campaign contributions and Washington lobbyists, including more than 100 former government employees. More than 100,000 people from across the country and a broad coalition of public interest and industry groups weighed in against the merger, warning that it would raise consumer prices, hurt competition, and endanger the emerging online video market. And yet, just days before Christmas, FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski circulated his plan to approve the deal with some conditions. A final vote could come as early as the first week in January.
In October, NPR made the personnel decision heard around the world, or at least the cable news networks, when it fired news analyst Juan Williams after he made controversial remarks about Muslims on Fox News. It didn't take long for a handful of politicians and commentators to seize on Williams' dismissal as an opportunity to attack all federal funding for public media outlets. But the public is rallying to defend, not defund, the public media system. More than 300,000 people spoke out in protest of these funding threats in just a few days, and congressional efforts to zero out funding were quickly defeated. In November, American Public Media and the Association of Public Television Stations launched a new initiative called 170 Million Americans for Public Broadcasting to fight back against budget cuts already being threatened by the new Republican leadership in Congress in 2011.
In the final hours of the 111th Congress, the House and the Senate sent the Local Community Radio Act to the president's desk. This bill will make it possible for the FCC to license hundreds, if not thousands, of new low-power FM radio stations across the country. These non-commercial stations have a broadcasting radius of about 3 to 5 miles and bring local voices, news, music, views, and opinions to the FM dial. The passage of this legislation marks the end of a decade-long struggle to expand community radio, led by the Philadelphia-based Prometheus Radio Project, an organization that helps communities build their own radio stations.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We're coming to you today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And our guest today is Sundiata Chajua, a professor of history and a professor of African American studies here at the University of Illinois, and also the president now of the National Council on Black Studies. Sundiata Chajua has written numerous articles and books and chapters in his career. And today we're going to be talking about a special issue of the Journal of the Black Scholar coming out early in 2011, which addresses the current political state of ethnic studies programs in the United States and the nature of American politics today and race issues and politics in general in the United States today. And a fascinating issue I've had a privilege to guest preview or pre-preview. I don't know what the term is. Sundiata Chajua, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Glad to be here, Bob. It's always great to speak with you.
Well, you and I talk off air all the time about a number of issues, politics and otherwise. And now, let's start the discussion today by something that's in your introduction, which I think a lot of people are talking about, which is, you know, what the 2008 election meant, and you know, which right now seems like about 200 years ago.
Yeah,
it really seems like, you know, it's another generation, another time almost, only about 25 months ago, 26 months ago. What was interesting in your introduction? You go through some of the demographics. What were some of the striking developments in the 2008 presidential election?
You know, as you said, that the 2008 election seemed like it was a moment in which America was being transformed. It had all of those possibilities, right? And so when you look at the kind of coalition that came together to vote President Obama into office, we're talking about real striking movements to the left on the part of a number of demographic groups. So, for example, if you take Asian Americans, I think in 1992, only 31% of Asian Americans voted for the Democratic Party. By the time we get to Obama, we're now up to about 63%. Mm-hmm. You know, that's overwhelming. Latinos, which had hovered even as late as 2004, maybe only 53, maybe 56% voted in favor of the Democrats. They move into the high 60s, mm-hmm, in terms of Obama. And, of course,
and that includes Cuban Americans,
which famously
the more conservative wing.
Right, right, absolutely, absolutely. But amongst youth, young Latino and Latina voters, 76% of them voted for Obama. Amongst youth in general, right? The data I looked at suggested that normally, there's less than a 2% gap between the way older people vote and the way younger people vote. Mm-hmm. Young people tend to vote with their families, right? Yeah. Well, in the case of Obama, they voted 2-1 for Obama.
I got to stop you there because I study this data a lot. That is an extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, this is simply unprecedented.
Unheard of.
That sort of shift of a generation.
Absolutely. And the fact that, well, at any rate, they end up being demobilized. But all of these
we'll
population groups, right? Even, you know, the data the media tended to focus on the gender gap, right? 7% of women voted more for Obama than for McCain. But the real issue, I think, that people tended to neglect is that amongst white non-college educated voters who were union members, right, they voted, 28% of them voted more for Obama. Right. So that showed that somehow being connected to being connected to a union, to the unions and a labor movement that came out fairly strong and aggressively on the question of race during the Obama campaign had impact. Right. So when you pull back and then understand that the base for Obama was 96% of African-Americans voted for Obama. And with each of these groups, right, African Americans, Latino Asians, you're also talking about record turnout, as well as with young people. So clearly, some of us thought that Obama had the possibility. I mean, I think you said it to me once, the possibility of putting together a coalition that could put the Democratic Party in power for a generation. And while we understood that this would not be a significant shift to the left, right, but we did see it as a progressive move. What's stark is that in 2 years, Obama has completely lost that base.
You know, let's go back for 1 second to the huge increase in voting turnouts for communities of color, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans. And what's striking, though, is that what happened was that these are communities that simply started to vote proportionally to how whites have traditionally voted and still far below what another democratic nation's people vote.
Right.
So we're not talking about like every single person in every community is like marching down to the polls. We're talking about finally getting levels of turnout comparable to what peer communities who are white or other nations, how people vote.
Right. No, absolutely. And in fact, I wouldn't even say comparable to what other nations vote. The U.S.
No, that's right.
I think.
And Latinos, too, are still well below everyone else, especially in the Southwest.
Right, absolutely. I mean, this country has so many things in place to de-incentivize people from voting so that we're talking about an electorate that really is closer to what it was in this last midterm election, old and white.
And, you know, you were getting to the point, and I want to get to it, too, which is, you know, this huge turnout came with certain expectations. I mean, people got off their butts and voted, not just as a symbolic step, but, I mean, they voted for the reason people vote. They wanted something, expected something. And what did they get, in your view?
Yeah. you know, this is delicate stuff in the sense that because of the hard shift to the right, which is a response to Obama, and the
right
overt racism of that right, the African American community, and I think other communities of color, we've been loath to come out and harshly criticize President Obama. But we have to be clear, and I'm gonna be as clear as I can.
Mm-hmm.
The combination of incompetence and cowardice. I mean, we've moved from caution to straight up political cowardice. He's allowed the right wing to set the agenda that, you know, look, we're forced to conclude that Obama is a Clintonian, triangulating neoliberal whose heart and soul is on the right side of the Democratic Party. And I don't mean that as in the good side, right?
Yeah, political right side.
So we've gotten very little. You know, we got a health care bill that whatever is there that's meaningful wouldn't happen until 2014, in which case it may never happen. The best thing I can think of that happened under the Obama administration is the decision to reach an agreement with African-American farmers and Native Americans, where I think African-American farmers will get about $1 billion for the discrimination and exploitation that they've suffered over the years, and Native Americans will get about $3 billion. Mm-hmm. I think that helps lay a precedence for reparations that we can begin to argue. But in general, in many ways, Obama has been worse than some of the fairly bad white presidents. I'll give you an example. Now, this is just symbolic, right?
Sure.
But the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, formed in 1915 by Carter G. Woods, is the oldest black scholarly association, has historically, for Black History Month, been brought to the White House, and they, you know, give a talk, and they announced the commemoration of the month. When Obama came in, he disinvited the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. Obama made the most absurd statement. He said that a rising tide lifts all boats. Speaking when he was approached by members of the Congressional Black Caucus to specifically target the question of African Americans and their declining condition in this society, and Obama came out with this very old and absurd kind of aphorism, when we know that tides in America rise and fall and black people remain on the bottom, right? So in many ways, the disappointment has been just, wow.
Well, you know what's interesting? I hear you talk, Cindy Shajawa, is that he got elected with this huge outturning of new voters. Yeah. And then basically, most of those new voters, a significant percentage of them, didn't return in 2010. And it seems like his policies are adjusted to or encouraging sort of the smaller electorate. And if you assume a very small electorate, then what he's doing, I guess, makes a certain amount of sense, because you're fighting then for people who weren't going to vote for you in the first place or didn't vote for you in 2008. You need their votes to win a majority suddenly. And then you're going to tailor your policies there. But you would never have gotten elected by those people in the first place.
Right. I mean, the point is that the assumption that you should accept this historically small electorate when you won on the basis of a record electorate, you would, you know, and Obama had the organization coming into the presidency to continue to build and expand on the base. He chose to shrink it. Now, you know, and that's why I have to think that some of this wasn't simply him being beat back in line by the right wing. Some of it is that he is, at the end of the day, a neoliberal himself, and that he buys into this type of elite definition of U.S. politics. Now, of course, as we approach 2012, you know, he'll try and return to that base. And, you know, we can only hope that there's someone in the Democratic Party that can effectively challenge him.
Our guest today, Professor Sundiata Chajuwa from the Department of History and of African American Studies here at the University of Illinois, author of numerous books and articles. And your first book, which was published by the University of Illinois Press, now it's 10 years ago, or 10-year decade,
yeah.
America's First Black Town, is
right,
that
title?
Yeah. Brooklyn, Illinois, 1830 to 1915.
Well, good memory, Bob.
Well, it's First Black Town. I mean, that's something that's a pretty memorable topic right there. And we're a recorded show. We're recording this late in December, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax, enjoy 2011, and let us do the yakking. You're also, and the reason we're having you today primarily, Sundiata, is you're the guest editor of a new edition, special issue of the Black Scholar, which deals with the crisis in what's happening with ethnic studies programs or racialized community studies, and not just in colleges and universities, but in public schools and K through 12 across the country. The real crisis is going on, and what we're talking now is putting it in the political context of the times. And I think that one of the points you make in your introductory piece, and one of the points that really underscores all the articles and overscores a couple of them, is the sort of political move to the right, dramatic, since the 2008 election, typified by or exemplified by what's called the Tea Party. And I know you've written about this, you've talked about it, and in a nutshell, or it can be a big nutshell, take as much time as you want, how would you characterize, how do you understand the Tea Party? What's your sense of it? And as you answer that, because most of our listeners have heard a lot of people talk about the Tea Party, what is the conventional coverage missing of the Tea Party in your view? What frustrates you the most when you hear the conventional wisdom about the Tea Party in the news media?
Well, I would say three things are frustrating. One is we're given a sense that it is, in fact, an organized political party and that it is a broad-based movement. It's a much larger movement than we would desire, but it's not nearly as large as it's treated in terms of the media. The left is much broader, and it doesn't get as near access. The other thing is that the racism, the Tea Party, while they are different factions, at the end of the day, you have factions that are explicitly racist, right? And very, very clear on that. And we see it not just in the science, but we see it in policy. And then we have factions that, if we follow the logic of their argument, right? And these are not dumb people. They understand that what they advocate ends up worsening the conditions of African-Americans and other darker peoples in this country.
The so, for example, Latinos
in particular. So you just take their argument, even if we could believe them at their word and say that what they stand for is limited government, ban of deaths, da, 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 da. Well, follow the logic of limited governments. What we know from history, right? And we can take Ronald Reagan as a prime example, that when Reagan passes that Budget Readjustment Act in 1981, that the immediate consequence, right, is to shrink social reproductive programs. And that has two effects on the African-American community.
Yeah, that's a term a lot of our listeners might not be familiar with, social reproductive programs.
Okay, so we're talking about programs that provide for the welfare of citizens. We're talking about things like welfare. It used to be called welfare. We're talking about things like Medicaid, Medicare. We're talking about Pell Grants. We're talking about those things that
education.
Help sustain the citizenry.
Yeah.
Okay? So one impact, of course, was that to reduce the services for the poor and working class, right? A number of people were kicked out of programs, programs shrink. But the other impact, because of the nature of racism in this society in private industry, if you take a majority of black lawyers, right, I think that something like at a level of 2-to-1, or actually greater than 2-to-1, black lawyers work for local, state, and federal governments than for private firms. And you can do that across every middle-class profession mm-hmm. for black people, and probably it's true for Latinos, that private industry does not employ black professionals in any broad sense, right? So that when you shrink the size of government, you're also cutting jobs for the black middle class,
mm-hmm.
right? And so these people are very conscious that these policies will have this impact. So that racism that's there, that's both explicit and implicit in the nature of the policies that they pursue. We have so much data that shows that when government grows, and I mean the social reproductive side of government mm-hmm, grows, mm-hmm. that is generally a consequence of the black freedom struggle,
mm-hmm.
and it generally has positive impact for the working class across race, has impact for not just blacks, but for other people of color, has benefits to young in terms of education. So we know that the growth of government in those areas actually benefits people in society. The third thing that bothers me in terms of the Tea Party is that this is a middle class movement financed by the wealthiest sectors of American society. So this is not a grassroots movement of the poor and the working class. This is a movement of people whose annual income, you know, is over $100,000, I think over $120,000. And they receive their funding from very identifiable, super elite right-wing ideologues.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than focus on those three elements of the Tea Party, that A, it's not that broad, B, it is explicitly racist, despite Ben Jealous's backing off, right?
Mm-hmm.
He should have never backed off, because it's clear that the party—
Who backed off?
Ben Jealous at the NAACP.
Oh, okay.
Right? And, you know, in other words, he allowed the media to put him in that situation where, are you saying
yeah.
everyone in the Tea Party is racist? Well, you're never saying that everyone in anything.
How would
no,
you know?
No, but what we're talking about the policies yeah. that they pursue,
yeah.
and we're talking about the symbols that they use mm-hmm. to organize and attract their followership, right?
Yeah.
And then this, you know, and this question of where their funding comes from and who they are. They are indeed the classic class and strata that go together to put fascist movements
in place. Right-wing populists, to be more be less pejorative.
No, I'm going to.
You'll be pejorative here. Yeah, you'll go.
I don't see it as pejorative.
It's okay. Fashion.
You know, I'm working from George Jackson's, you know, Blood in My Eye, the last book that he wrote before he was assassinated. He has a long section in there about fascism in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I think that people need to read it and we need to think about it in those kinds of terms. Because what happens is that there's a move in this society for African-American scholars and activists and people of color to censor our interpretations to conform with the mainstream. Mm-hmm. So rather than refer to lynching and those race riots as called race riots pogroms, because they weren't spontaneous, they were organized, rather than talk about lynching as terrorism, right? So that we can talk about real terrorism in America, not these myths. Mm-hmm. We get beaten off, right? Rather than call segregation apartheid, mm-hmm. we get beaten off into talking about it as it's separation. You know, we got to be clear. Mm-hmm. And we have to argue for our interpretation of these things in terms of how they impact our community, and that we have to define those terms.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Professor Sundiata Chajua from the University of Illinois Department of History and its African American Studies program.
It's a department now.
So on top of things I am here. I'm Bob McChesney, the host here, and we are coming to you as a recorded program done in late December just before going on air. So please don't call in today to WILL. Just sit back, listen, relax, let us do the talking. We're talking about the new forthcoming issue of The Black Scholar, which Sundiata was the lead editor for, and is the issue of American politics today, specifically racialized community studies, the crisis in these programs, not only at the university level, but at the K through 12 level. And the discussion so far has been putting it in context, talking about American politics today, what's going on, and the Tea Party presently. And just the last thing I want to talk about in the Tea Party before we go forward is to amplify the point you were making. You know, it seems like every Tea Party rally gets extensive coverage in the news media. I think when they had one of those conferences that Sarah Palin spoke at, was paid some enormous sum to give a talk at, and it drew, I don't know, 1 or 2,000 people maybe.
Right.
I'm not sure the exact number. But I think every news television news channel and news division national had a film crew there and a reporter, not to mention print reporters. In roughly the same time, maybe a couple months later, in Detroit, Michigan, there was the U.S. Social Forum was held. In June, which drew 15,000 people, right. Americans from across the country, with no publicity at all, that came together, and it was completely uncovered. I mean, if the federal government issued a mandate saying this should not be covered, this we refuse to let anyone cover this, it couldn't have been more effective. In fact, it would have been less effective because it would have drawn attention to it.
And let me go further on the U.S. Social Forum. That in fact, in communities across the country, there were meetings to organize and send delegates so that these people were actually delegates from their community. So they represented something much broader. The other kind of thing that I find striking, Tuesday, there was a prison strike in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. And again, we're recording this, so this is a couple weeks earlier.
Okay. So mid-December,
there we go, yeah.
There's a prison strike in Georgia, which turns out to be the largest prison strike in the history of the country. Mm-hmm. It involves 10 prisons, and what's, in terms of, you know, its breadth, but also prisons are a site for a kind of virulent, you know, racial antipathies. Mm-hmm. But somehow, these prisoners were able to unite across race to do this strike.
That's incredible.
Right? That's incredible.
That's a story.
Right? What this could in fact mean, right, is extremely transformative.
That is a man-bite-dog story. I mean, that sticks out.
I've only heard it on Link. Not one mainstream media channel has uttered a word, and CNN is in Atlanta.
That's really extraordinary. It's really quite true. And given that, you know, we've talked about this, and I think it's well known to people who follow it, the enormous growth of the prison complex in this country in the last 30 years, what a huge role it plays now, especially in communities of color, that this is a major story.
Absolutely.
This makes Attica look like small potatoes almost by comparison.
You see, Bob, the failure to publicize that is highly understandable if we pay any serious attention to what happened in the 60s. In other words, when you read the Kerner Report, what happens is that people get pushed to focusing on the Kerner Report being the first government-issued document to say that the problem in the society is white racism. Mm-hmm. But the Kerner Report also proposes a number of solutions and behaviors. And when it comes to the media, they say very explicitly, do not give these radicals airtime. Do not publicize these kinds of events. And so since the Kerner Commission, there's been a de-emphasis on the part of not just African-American, but left movement. They simply don't give those things publicity. And that's part of the game plan. You know, again, that's we got to read these things both ways.
Well, Cindy, let's go now to the 2010 election. So we've been sort of getting to this point. But what's your take? What happened in 2010?
That
did this country turn? Did the people of this country wake up and say, we're really fed up with these liberal big spending government policies, and now we want to return to small government? Is that
No. That's not what happened. You know, I listened to your show with Nichols.
Yeah,
a very good show.
Well, thank you. I'll tell John.
You know, John and you had it right. What happened is that the American electorate went back to what it's historically been. That 208 broke the mold, and so it just returned to the narrow base. See, I believe that America is still, by and large, a liberal society, and that if you can avoid buzzwords, right, you actually end up with a fairly progressive society. If you just ask people questions about the kind of society they want, the kind of position they want on social, other than race, okay, you're in a fairly progressive society.
Yeah.
But the electorate,
I think the research backs
that up.
Very,
very, very, you know, it's what we say, it's older white people that's unrepresentative of what the society is. Yeah.
Yeah. So going forward, we'll see where this takes us. But one of the ways this is playing out right now, and let's get to the subject of the special issue, which is the state of ethnic studies or racialized community studies. Programs in colleges and universities, not just at Illinois, but across the nation, and also in public schools districts, K through 12. And there's one term that you use that I think is, you know, not familiar to a lot of people, called the beige crayon. And I think that sort of is a really – I think that's sort of something that, especially for people who are not people of color, who are used to thinking of themselves as sort of the default system of the human race – that it's sort of jarring because it sort of alerts you to how the world actually looks to other people. So explain the beige crayon.
Well, you know, actually, I'm borrowing the term from a guy by the name of James, I think it's pronounced Pearl Beale, former public school educator. And he describes an event where he's at I think it's a second or third grade, and the kids have been asked to draw a picture and color themselves. And he notices that at this black school, all of these black kids color themselves with a beige crayon. And he questions them by saying, you know, look at you, look at, and the person and the young kid responds, that's the way it's supposed to be, right? And so once you begin to deconstruct that and you think about all of the markers in this society, right? Remember they used to have what they called flesh-colored Band-Aid?
I sure did.
And, of course, it was beige.
Yeah.
You know, the push is just so striking in every way to as you say, to normalize whiteness. And by that definition, then everything else is a deviation.
Exactly.
You know, removed. And that's what's at issue here. And that's precisely what we call it racialized community studies, but the term is ethnic studies, and I'll talk about the distinction at a certain point. But the idea that this move to challenge what were intellectual assaults, right, on the somatic image of people of African descent and other people of color, that obviously that was at the heart of this project of racialized community studies, but the other part of it was to resuscitate the subjugated knowledge of these populations and to bring that into the curriculum. And so that movement that really picked up steam in the 60s, it doesn't begin there, right? Mm-hmm. But because of the nature of the social forces in that decade, it gains real steam, that the response on this shift to the hard right is to go precisely at that transformation, because the right came to power by focusing on local school board elections, because they understood that, you know, you control ideas. And that's what they went after, and they pushed those things to the right. What makes Texas, right, particularly important here is that it was such a big state, right? And they have a large elementary and secondary school population. And so the tendency has been, since Texas is a state where the superintendent's office selects the textbooks for all schools.
It's completely centralized.
Completely centralized.
It's a Soviet centralized model.
Soviet, Nazi,
whatever.
Right. Complete state control model. And so that means then that they influence the selection of textbooks everywhere else, because they determine, they have such a phenomenal impact on what types of textbooks get produced. So what we see coming out of Texas and out of Arizona last spring is, going right at the heart of how you get Obama elected in 2008, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you talk about those young people, I posit this. I haven't done a study, but here's what I would posit. What you're going to find is that those young people across the board, right, white, black, Latino, Asian, that they probably had a course in African-American, Latino, Latina, Asian American, American Indian studies, or some type of quote unquote ethnic studies, racial or community studies that impacted them, right? Because these things have transformative possibilities.
Yeah.
And so this is undercutting that possibility. That's what's happening there.
Our guest today is Cindy Adachajewa, professor of history and African American studies here at the University of Illinois. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it towards the end of December. So please don't try to call in today. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Cindy Adachajewa is also the president of the National Council on Black Studies. When did your term begin?
Began in July.
Do you have a tough re-election campaign coming up, or is it a...
No. I'm into 2012.
2012, okay.
Obama and I will be running at the same time.
Not on the same ticket, though.
Not on the same ticket.
Sure.
Different policies.
Well, let's... there's so much to talk about here, and there's a lot of directions I want to go in. Let's get some stuff on the table before I go into Glenn Beck and that stuff. What was striking in some of the articles in this chapter was how successful these programs have been. You talked about at the college level the influence they've had on kids, we can say it at our age. But, in Arizona, in Tucson, one of the articles talks about an extraordinary program and how successful it's been that's now been cut. Let's talk about this.
Augustine Romero, who I think is the diversity officer for the city of Tucson's Unified School District, he and a number of people at Latino Studies at the University of Arizona created this program called the Mexican American Studies Program at Tucson. And what's phenomenal about it is that over the past 7 years, they've had something like 1,100 students, right? And the students are overwhelmingly Mexican American students who, like African American students, tend not to do well in the public school system. But in this case, in this particular program, right, they read at a level that's four times higher. They do math at a level that's three times higher. It's just phenomenally successful. They score higher on the state standardized test. They get admitted to college at a rate greater than the graduating class in the state. I mean, by every above the scale on every indicator, this is the kind of program that you would be highlighting. You know, we would have seen them on 60 Minutes, right?
Yeah.
And the people would be talking about pouring money into it. It would be the model.
Well, how can we do this elsewhere?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But instead, because they did, I would argue because the program is, A, focused on Mexican-Americans in Arizona, but specifically because that program, as Romero points out in his article, they take as the basis for developing the intellectual capacities of these students, they take seriously their identity. They talk about their culture as an asset, right? They build on the strengths and the resiliency of the culture rather than treat it as a negative. And they teach the kids how to analyze their lived environment, right? And that leads to a criticism of the school district.
Critical thinking.
Critical thinking, yeah. Right? And so for that reason, then, these right-wing politicians come after it. And rather than use it as a model to build other similar programs, they, in fact, target it for elimination. And we see the nastiness of it in this law, SB
HB 2281. Yeah. And so the Governor Brewer has gained a certain amount of acclaim out there or notoriety in Arizona for her kind of – you call Arizona – you've – let's this is one of my favorite words. You compare Arizona today to Mississippi in the late 19th century for being the most racist state in the country, which is coming for you, I think, high quite an honor. And I think that I shouldn't laugh, obviously. This is not a funny matter.
Right. It's just a statement about where we are.
But I think also, since you're a historian who's written about the history of Mississippi, and I think I've learned from you talking to you about this. I mean, I don't think Americans quite know America's own history from the period between, say, 1865 and 1900. I think most Americans assume, understandably, that, okay, you had the war, slavery was eliminated, then something funny happened in the 1870s and they instituted Jim Crow and then everything went that way until 1965. More or less, that's America's truncated history. And in fact, though, I mean, why the comparison to Mississippi becomes more important when you know the actual history. Just briefly tell if you can, like what took place in Mississippi, the most racist state in the country between 1865 and 1900, that bears light on what's going on today?
Let me first say, Bob, that surprising for you, you actually give the American people too much credit.
Okay.
They're not just ignorant.
I always
do that.
Of the period
from 1865 to – they're ignorant of their entire history.
Yeah.
But, you know, what makes Mississippi important here is that it was the single state that pioneered – the type of policies that would then be picked up across the South, so that its initial response to Reconstruction is what's called the First Mississippi Plan. And the decision is simply, how do you respond to the Union League?
What year is this roughly? Right after
we're talking right after 1867, 1867.
Okay.
So you get the passage of these black codes, which restrict African Americans. It forces you to sign a labor contract by January 1st, or you're a vagrant. If you have a dispute, say, with a landlord, and you decide that you're not being paid, or you're not being paid enough, or there's a dispute over the hours, or any kind of dispute, and you decide that you want to move on to another employer, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You become a vagrant, and then you, of course, are arrested. And we can't have you laying up in a jail cell. We then, as the state, rent you out to a plantation owner who needs, right?
And Mississippi is pretty much a majority African American state.
Mississippi, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Louisiana are majority African American states.
Wow.
And especially in what we call the Black Belt,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So Mississippi pioneers with a policy that says, we simply are going to respond to this black resurgence, the election to a political office. We're simply going to kill them. So they just use terror. They just kill, rape, and pillage, right? By the time we get to 1890, and, you know, the Congress, radical Republicans have responded in some ways with the Force Acts in 1870, 1871, Civil Rights Act of 1875, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you get to 1890, the question becomes, well, how can we disfranchise this majority black population, but not disfranchise poor whites who represent the same class status, right?
So you want to have racially specific, but it can't be racially specific technically.
That's right. It has to technically be
colorblind.
Right. And we know that that's always a euphemism. So they come up with a poll tax, property qualification literacy tests. And then, of course, so that they can bring poor whites back in through the back door, they come up with the grandfather clause.
That's the killer.
Your grandfather voted or your father voted in 1860. Well, blacks were slaves still in 1860, right?
Unbelievable.
So these people are...
Shouldn't laugh again.
No, you shouldn't, but they're so devious, yeah. Right? Insidious. And so Mississippi pioneered these things that would then be taken up by the rest of the South and would slowly and gradually infect the rest of the nation, right? So the argument is that today, in response to growing Latino population in Arizona, right, they're now 43%. When the 2010 census data finally comes out, it's going to be much greater. But we certainly know we're not going to get to 2030 with Arizona being a majority white state.
No, that's
not
going to
happen. Right, probably not 2020. Yeah. Texas is already a majority Latino and African American state.
Except on voting day.
Right. Arizona has become this type of model for the right. So, you look at the anti-immigration bill, you look at the anti-ethnic studies, and there's a host of crazy stuff they passed. They even passed a law where you could carry a concealed weapon without a permit for a concealed weapon. You know what I mean? Some of this stuff is so crazy. Mm-hmm. But it's just marching us further to the right, and it's become the motto.
And they've taken dead aim on racialized communities
yeah,
at all
absolutely.
Levels. These are like, I saw a quote from Forbes.com, and they called these programs ethnic cheerleading as a substitute for knowledge. And I know you said you hear this all the time. I mean, knowing how hard you work and how diligent you are in your research and how demanding you are in your students. I found this personally outrageous.
I had this young white female student tell me once that her father at midterm wanted to, see the grades. And so she goes over the grades. She had all A's except for B in African-American studies. Of course, she was taken with me. And so the father said, so you didn't put much work into this class so that you could focus on your other? She said, no, actually, I do more work in this class than I do in any of the others. And so he said, well, how could you be getting a B? And she said, because it's hard, Dad. And he just could not wrap his mind around it.
One of the things, and we've only got about 10 or 11 minutes left.
Oh, wow.
In this. Yeah, I know. There's so much to talk about. We should always do a double show. But I do want to talk about something that comes up in the journal. And I think that's something that most of our listeners are familiar with, which is Glenn Beck, who's become sort of, I think, the voice of a certain branch of the Tea Party. And I think the branch you're talking about to a large extent.
Absolutely.
He's done something quite striking. He has embraced Martin Luther King as his personal guru and actually held some sort of Glenn Beckathon at the Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C. this past summer. And this is really interesting. What's going on there, and what's your take on it?
Well, Beck is actually the latest to do that. But if we go back into the 80s, right, we're going to find that that's when the right wing first began to take up Martin Luther King. Shelby Steele, this black right wing guy, wrote a book, The Content of Character, in mm-hmm. which he takes that quote from King and he takes it completely out of context and he tries to present King as someone interested in individualism and in that kind of notion. So Beck is merely picking up a tradition that the conservatives have worked on hard since the 1980s, because the idea was to try and mask their racism. And so if you present yourself as a proponent of King, somehow you're supposed to be read that that's supposed to disarm people, when in fact, you said that he's embraced King. He hasn't embraced King. He's embraced a myth that the right created of Martin Luther King, and it's actually revolting. And you know, people need to, you know, just expose it for what it is.
Well, I mean, anyone who's studied Dr. King at all, whether you're a fan of his or not, just a historical study of Martin Luther King, he would never stop throwing up. I mean, to find his name is being used in this light, especially by politicians who embrace all sorts of militarism, who embrace sort of the crudest economic inequality. King, if nothing else, was an anti-militarist and a socialist. I mean, those issues are...
When King was assassinated, he was leading the Poor People's Campaign, which called for a guaranteed annual wage, called for a sharp reduction of unemployment, almost elimination of unemployment, and on and on and on. So yeah.
And one of the issues, Cindy, that comes up, and I think you've alluded to this, but we haven't got it directly, is people say, well, how come traditional schools, K through 12, or colleges and universities, why can't the sociology department, the history department, the communications department, why can't they just take up issues of racialized communities in their normal study? You know, just to make that part of that. Why do we need a specialized program?
Well, I've got two kinds of responses to that. One is that Black studies, Latino-Latina studies, Asian American studies, American Indian studies, that these are disciplines too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first response. These are areas of knowledge and research that have their own set of theories, concepts, conceptualizations. The other point is that you can't study African-American people from the vantage point of one traditional discipline. The third point...
It's interdisciplinary by nature.
Right, it's interdisciplinary by nature.
Yeah.
The third point is that let's look at those departments. And I can assure you that you can go anywhere in this country and you're going to find... there was a moment when the African American Studies unit at University of Illinois, there were 80 African American faculty.
How many?
80. That's the highest point. 80 out of 2,000, right?
Oh, okay.
Yep. Black faculty. 80 black faculty out of 2,000 faculty. And 20 had appointments in African American studies, and another 15 had affiliate or zero time appointments for African American studies.
Our academic listeners know what you're talking about.
So when you know, actually look at that number of 80, you end up with 35 have some relationship to African American studies. You can go through whole colleges, right, and find 4 or 5 black people.
Mm-hmm.
You can go there. The number of departments that have zero is just striking. And this, you know, this isn't just the University of Illinois. Illinois probably is in the mid-range. But there, you can go anywhere across this country.
Yeah.
Anywhere. So if these units were going to do that, what's preventing them?
That's right.
Right?
No, I agree. And that's been my experience. And I mean, I ask that obviously as a rhetorical question.
Yeah, obviously.
Because I see from my own experience in a department, in a field, that the issues just aren't getting raised.
Right.
When I talk to you and I learn stuff all the time just from talking to you, that people ought to know in our department, in our field, and ought to be taught. And it's not getting taught.
I do want to raise a question. And I want to do this.
Hey, it's my show.
but we got a relationship. My Knicks almost beat your Celtics.
Almost.
You know, I'm loath to use the term crisis for black studies at the university level. I do think that the budget crisis is creating opportunities at particular universities for rescissions that are across the board but have deeper impact on racialized community studies units because they were never well financed, mm-hmm. right? But there are places where we're seeing new PhD programs emerge, but there are also places where a reconfiguration is occurring, and this reconfiguration has really negative effects and possibilities. I give two examples. Working off in an article by Gary Okahiro, who ran Asian American Studies at Columbia University. It appears that at Columbia, they've decided to take the Institute for African American Studies, the Center for Latino-Latina Studies, Women's Studies, and merge them into something called the Center for the Study of Critical Difference, right? Which basically would
You put all the left wingers in there too. I mean,
I don't know what the thing. You know, can't get my mind around this amorphous piece of mess. But so there's that kind of move which rips the particularity, right? And the way to get to universality is through particularity. You don't get to particularity through universality. You got to go the other way. The other thing is that at Cornell University, a provost has taken an arrangement that has existed for 40 years where you have an Africana center. And they exist as a center rather than a department. And then the arrangement that was worked out back 40 years ago was that this center would report to the provost. Their budget would come from the provost's office. When they sent people up for tenure, they would go through a departmental vote. There'd be external reviews, and then it would go to the provost's office, right? Because they were like their own college, okay? So this provost decides or argues that there are departments in the College of Arts and Sciences that would like to be supportive of, because, you know, you always frame it as they want to help you.
To better serve you.
They want to be supportive of Africana studies, and they want to upgrade it to a PhD program. So they're going to arbitrarily, against the will of the faculty, move them into the College of Arts and Sciences, where now this unit has been highly successful, has produced outstanding scholars, Kimberly Crenshaw, the outstanding critical race theorist. She came out of that. A number of young, very important historians have come out of that. Leslie Alexander, Scott Brown. We've got a person at the University of Illinois came out of that program, Rayvon Fouché. Number of people right around the country. And without giving any hoot about faculty self-governance, they just arbitrarily make the move. Now, those kinds of reconfigurations are the kinds of things that we see as dangerous. We know at this historical moment they cannot eliminate, right? But what they can do is reconfigure in a way in which they are meaningless, or they move toward a
or
kind of meaningless.
Easier
where decisions,
to eliminate later.
Where the control immediately goes out of the hands of the faculty and into others.
So is that a true-false question for me, or is it? You said, I thought it was a question for me.
No.
Okay, good. True? we've only got a minute or so left, and I guess what I'd like to do now, Sindhiata, is for listeners who want to learn more and get some more background, they go to the new issue of the Black Scholar. Will that be posted online, hopefully?
They can go to the blackscholar.com, and the new issue. Okay, this should come out in early January, maybe late December. Well, no, I don't think it'll make December. Should be out in January. And I'd say go to the website and order it. You can pick it up in some of your, if there are still some progressive bookstores around, you can pick it up. And you know, it's focusing on the defense of racialized community studies.
We've only got 30 seconds or so left, but I do want something I meant to get to. It's very important, which is some research that's come out that shows that the success of African-American students at the university is closely related to how well they have a sense of their own identity and their
own.
I mean, it's just like it's really rock solid research. And that points to exactly that. This is sort of like Arizona. When you lose these programs, basically you're saying to a generation of African-American kids, you're not welcome here.
No, Bob, you said it best. I don't even need to comment on that.
That was my true-false question.
There you go. Yeah, absolutely.
Our guest today on Media Matters has been Professor Sindhiata Chajuwa from the Department of History and African American Studies here at the University of Illinois. I'm Bob McChesney. I've been your host. Thank you all for joining us today, and I want to thank Mike Pritchard for recording the show for us in the studio. I'll be back 1 week from today, 167 hours with a live show. I'll see you then. Thank you very much.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Sunshine will dominate the forecast today, and we'll have a high near 27. Mostly clear tonight, low around 17. Tomorrow, sunny, high near 36. And then on Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high of 31. We'll cool back into the teens by Friday. Wind today and tonight from the southwest at 10, tomorrow gusting up to 15. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.